You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We live in a time of unprecedented bounty in which we have constant access to a seemingly unending variety of food. But as food prices rise and the threat of foodborne illnesses like salmonella and E. coli become more common, questions arise about whether our modern food system is sustainable. Have we reached the limits of cheap and safe food production? Paul Roberts explores these issues and the world's food economy in his new book, The End of Food. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to the show. Hi.
Good morning, or good afternoon, rather.
My food costs seem to have risen sharply recently. Is it just my imagination?
No. It's not. Food prices are going up around the world, and no less so in the United States. It depends on what particular food you're talking about, but basically anything that requires corn or oil in its production is going to be more expensive.
So this is connected to some degree to the recent spike in the cost of petroleum?
Yeah, I mean, our food system is really built for cheap oil. I mean, it requires a lot of energy to grow food and also to move that food from the farm to the market. And our food system was really built for oil at, you know, $15 a barrel. So as oil's nearly 10 times that level, a lot of that gets passed down. And then, of course, you have the additional sort of linkage of the biofuels sector, which is sort of connected oil with food in a new way.
Is this just an inconvenience, or are there dangers in this spike?
Well, I think that it depends where you're living. If you're in the United States and you've seen food prices go up substantially, you're still paying, you know, some of the lowest food costs in the world. We pay on average less than a dime of every household dollar for our food. Now, obviously, there are pockets in this country where we're paying significantly more for our food, and it hurts quite a bit more. But the question becomes much more serious when you go to a country, say in sub-Saharan Africa, where you were paying already 60 to 70% of your household income for food. Then when you see the grain prices, you know, triple, that can be deadly. So it really depends where you live. But in all cases, we're all sort of feeling the consequences of this shift in the food economy.
But in sub-Saharan Africa, in some cases, there is also the political aspect. Troubled countries like Somalia and Zimbabwe, where inflation is totally out of hand.
That's right. And we've had, I mean, one of the most important sort of discoveries about hunger and food insecurity generally came with the understanding that food insecurity is often not caused by the lack of food. In many cases, some of these hard-hit countries have tons of food, you know, plenty of food on hand. It's just they can't get it to the afflicted areas. There are political problems. Weather is bad. Roads haven't been repaired, and so they just can't move the food to the places where it's needed. Or in some cases, the hungry just don't have the money to buy it. So we have gotten accustomed to thinking of food insecurity as a very complex and largely political problem that will require political solutions. Now, all those problems continue today, but there is an additional factor, which is now that we have actual scarcity. So you have all the problems of politically unstable countries having a hard time moving food to the places where it needs to go. And in addition to that, now food is simply more expensive.
Well, in this country, scarcity doesn't seem to be the big issue, but other things have gotten people really upset. Is the recent salmonella outbreak in tomatoes similar to past outbreaks?
Well, it is in the sense that when we first of all, we still don't know where it originated. We have focused on farms in Mexico, but we've also begun to look at warehouses and packing facilities. As we discover that tomatoes are often packed and repacked dozens of times, as different processors look for different sizes and grades and ripenesses of tomatoes to sell to particular customers. So there are so many different points where a pathogen could enter the tomato supply chain, if you will, that it's very, very tough for inspectors to figure out where it is and contain it. And I think that generally speaks to the sort of the food system that has evolved in this country. We pride ourselves on a food system that, you know, can produce vast quantities of, say, fresh produce in many parts of the country or many parts of the hemisphere, and then ship it quickly so that you can have your, you know, tomatoes or lettuce fresh within hour, within, you know, 48 hours of the time that it was picked. Now that's the benefit, that we eat more produce and it's relative and it's more cheap, you know, more cheaply than in the past. The downside is that once again, once a pathogen enters the system, it can be in your home and essentially in your gut before health officials even know an outbreak has occurred.
Well, we had that spinach scare last year, and then there were the green onions and packaged salads not long before that. So is this something that is becoming more frequent?
Well, it is. Now, there's a really interesting debate going on. This debate is so easily politicized. I mean, depending on what axe you need to grind, you can, you know, find someone to blame and claim that it's a sign of, you know, everything falling apart. But I think what's really critical to note is that we are getting better at detecting outbreaks. We're getting better at seeing them and then linking them to other outbreaks. You know, in the past, I mean, when you and I were growing up, there was lots of foodborne illness, but it was very tough to know that an outbreak in, say, Seattle, Washington was the same bug as an outbreak in Washington, D.C. or New York City. Now we have the capacity, the technological capacity, to link those and say, oh, they are the same bug, the same DNA, and they come from the same place. So we're getting better at spotting them, and as we get better at spotting them, the reported frequency will increase. That said, what we also see is that there was a general decline in outbreaks in fresh produce and in meat in particular during the 90s and early 2000s. And this was really a reason for great celebration because we had sort of beaten, we thought, or we were beating the odds in terms of improving food safety and finding the last sort of bastions of these pathogens. And then in the sort of early 2000s, we began to see a reversal in that success. And so we're seeing greater frequency in terms of rates of pathogens in meat. And, of course, we're seeing almost routine outbreaks in fresh produce.
My guest is Paul Roberts, whose latest book is follow-up to The End of Oil, is The End of Food. And appropriately, the image on the cover is of a stalk of corn. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. As you said earlier, it's been a goal to produce a lot of food cheaply. Have we reached the fullest potential for doing this?
Probably not. I mean, I hope not, because we've got a lot more people to feed in the coming decades. When I say we, I mean the United States made that a very official federal goal in the early part of the 20th century, that we weren't going to suffer the same fate that Europe had. Europe in the late 19th and early 20th centuries was having chronic food shortages and was suffering all kinds of dietary deficiencies that were leaving the population tired, physically and mentally stunted. And, there are these great reports where you can see that the military in England, for example, is trying to draft up an army to fight the Boer War, and it discovers that they have to lower the minimum height to get into the army from 5'4 to 5 foot even, because too many lower class, you know, working class men are too short to qualify. So the United States looked at that and said, you know, you simply can't run an industrial economy with food shortages. You need lots of food to keep our workers working. And we embarked on this massive campaign that would involve not only opening up the West and the Midwest for farming, but creating all kinds of new sort of government-supported research for technologies, new seeds, new machines, fertilizers, irrigation. And the result of that was that we could produce more food more cheaply than any nation ever in the history of the planet. And we became, I think that became built into our culture, our sort of expectation about what America could do with food and what humans could do with food.
But hasn't that come at a price? At least if you speak to some people like Alice Waters, they say that with this all of this food, we have lower nutrition, we have serious obesity problems, we are creating food monocultures that have pretty much eliminated a lot of very valuable potatoes and tomatoes and other things. You know, now suddenly there's the move to bring back heirloom tomatoes because of concerns about this kind of mass production.
Well, right. I think you reach a threshold in the beginning, perhaps in the 60s and 70s, where people begin to realize, wow, you know, we're getting a lot of food cheaply, but look at the costs. You know, look at the quality of the food, look at the declining nutritional content, both in terms of the food we're growing. I mean, we're just now seeing that some of the produce that's grown on these very high-yield farms has a lower nutritional content. There are actually fewer important minerals and vitamins in the produce because the soils aren't being taken care of properly. They're being fertilized with synthetic fertilizers as opposed to organic fertilizers. So you've got that issue. You have the issue of, well, we have so much cheap food. We can sell it in all sorts of forms, including a lot of junk food. So you have the element of the diet. And then I think, you know, beginning in the 70s, we began to look at the costs on the landscape. The commercial farming, commercial livestock production, commercial crop farming is quite hard on the soil, on the environment. And it's so hard that it actually ruins the soil's capacity to produce food. In many cases, you actually have to raise the amount of fertilizer you put into the soil simply to maintain your yields. And as fertilizer costs become more expensive, you see sort of you're backing yourself into a corner there.
Hasn't it also added to hidden costs, costs that are separate from the actual cost of the food? These environmental problems sometimes have to be cleaned up.
Well, they do, and that's exactly right. When you and I go to the store and buy something made of corn, for example, we don't pay for the cost that some state agency has to foot to pay to clean the nitrogen fertilizer out of their water supply. That nitrogen fertilizer washed off the cornfield, ended up into a drinking water supply or into a river where it promotes massive algae blooms, which then die off and create these huge dead zones. So there are these costs that someone has to pay for. You and I don't pay for them at the store, but we will pay for them in the form of taxes, and I think even worse, we will pay for them in the form of lower productivity in the future when we realize that we can't produce the amount of food that we used to on a given plot of land because we've so disrupted the soil structure.
We have been very concerned about lax rules and regulations in China, but aren't other countries kind of concerned about the same sort of thing from the United States? There have been food riots in Korea in protest over the importation of U.S. beef.
Right, and I think that there we have to distinguish between, the chances of catching mad cow. I mean, the concern there was the South Koreans are allegedly concerned that by resuming the beef trade from the United States to South Korea, they are setting themselves up for risk of getting mad cow. And I mean, the chances of getting mad cow are so slight. I mean, I'd be far more concerned about, the concern that your arteries are going to clog because you're taking corn-fed beef, which has, higher content of sort of the bad fats. Really, I mean, the mad cow issue in South Korea is mostly a quest of nationalism. It's something for politicians to whip up support over. But there are many, many food trade issues that are of legitimate concern. I mean, we're talking about high food prices and high corn prices in particular. Keep in mind the United States and to some degree Europe spent decades telling countries like Mexico, look, you don't need to produce so much grain here at home. You Mexicans, I mean, you have all these small, inefficient farms. It doesn't make sense to try to grow your own corn with this inefficient system. Instead, you should consolidate your small farms. You should move some of these small farmers into the city where they can take jobs in factories, and you should buy your corn. You should import it from the United States because we are famous for producing it at very low cost. And that was really one of the sort of arguments underpinning NAFTA and many of these other trade agreements. And so, the Mexicans and many other countries began moving toward this more modern farm system where they have fewer farmers and they are more dependent on cheap grain from the United States. And then what happens? Cheap grain is no longer so cheap. I mean, at the time what we were talking about NAFTA, corn was at under $2 a bushel, and now we're looking at corn at $7.50 a bushel. And because of all the flooding in the Midwest and the anticipated poor harvest this fall, we're expecting to see corn between $10 and $12 a bushel.
Paul Roberts is the author of The End of Food, published by Houghton Mifflin. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Paul Roberts. He's written a book called The End of Food. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Paul, how big a role have food processors like Nestle had on agriculture?
Well, huge. I mean, there were, you know, these companies in the late 19th century essentially began reshaping the food system from one that had been composed of, you know, many millions of small producers, small farmers, small processors, dealing directly with consumers, changing that system to one in which everything was funneled from farms through a small number of huge processors like Nestle's and then back out to consumers. So it kind of turned it into an hourglass. You picture the market as sort of the shape of the hourglass with the food processors at that narrow part and really acting as gatekeepers. So they changed the shape of the food economy. They changed certainly the kinds of foods we were eating. You know, they really introduced the notion of convenience and prepared foods. And of course, then the whole notion of food marketing. I mean, you know, the idea that you would advertise food and you'd build up a brand presence and you'd sort of create attributes to associate with that brand that might have nothing to do with food. I mean, you'd bring in a, you know, a baseball star or a movie star whose, you know, expertise in food might be limited, but it didn't matter because they were attractive. You were drawn to that brand. So really kind of taking food out of the realm of something that you simply ate or that had, you know, kind of cultural and personal meaning and turn it into something with a much broader meaning. And keep in mind, you know, that we many of us embrace this with open arms. We're, you know, in 1900, this country was, we still spent half of our household hours, our labor hours, preparing, processing food. And so the idea that a company would come along and help us with that, do some of that processing for us, that was great. We were quite happy to see that, particularly the women who were doing most of the food processing work. So, and again, it's one of those things which what begins as a great success and a great benefit begins to be somewhat questionable as we begin to see some of the hidden costs associated with that transformation.
Well, what percentage of our food costs are paying for the marketing?
Well, it depends on the food and it depends on what food you're talking about and also who's doing the measuring, because if you just look at the farm gate costs, that is what the farmer earns for the food that he or she sells into the food chain, it's under 20%. I mean, most of the costs we pay are for marketing. But it depends on where you want to draw the line. If you want to look at, say, advertising costs, a substantial, and then you look at, say, breakfast cereals, a huge portion of the money that you pay for a breakfast cereal just goes to marketing that breakfast cereal. It has nothing to do with the making of it or the growing of the grain that went into it. If you're looking at sort of foods that have less processing in them, say vegetables, then the marketing is a much smaller portion of the price you pay.
But now there's a third factor. Large grocers, big outfits like Walmart, also have major influence over food producers.
That's right. In the 1980s, you really see this shift, kind of a power shift. Up until that point, again, the food processors, by which we mean the Nestle's and the Kraft's and the Unilever's, the Sara Lee's, these companies were called the captains of the channels that the food ran through, and they ran everything. They dictated what farmers grew to a large extent, the kinds of vegetables, the varieties, and the prices that they were paid for those at the one end, at the supply end, and then on the demand end, they told grocery stores essentially how to shelve those products. Well, in the 1970s and 80s, the retailers, the grocers, rebelled, and they said, you know, this is ridiculous. There's no reason for us to give you this much power. And big discounters like Walmart essentially remade the system by saying, we will control. We have so much business. You know, so much of the food dollars in this country go through our doors. In the case of Walmart, it's up to 25%. That you can't do anything without us. You Nestle's, you Unilever, you can't survive without us. So we will tell you what kinds of products to make, and we will also tell you how much we'll pay. We'll also dictate price. And that has been a sea change. You know, we've always striven to make food cheaper, but with the retailers now demanding huge price cuts, and if you keep in mind that manufacturers like Nestle's had been able to raise prices steadily over the last century, now all of a sudden they were being forced to either keep prices flat or even push them down. And what they had to do, the food processors had to do to meet these new price requirements has been astonishing and has further transformed the system. And it's really, I think, the root of a lot of the problems we're looking at. They've had to cut costs in all sorts of ways. Now, some of them are fairly traditional and familiar. They've had to consolidate, build bigger factories. They've had to automate a lot more of their processes. So we're sort of used to hearing about those. The ones that get less attention but need more attention are the way that they've cut their labor costs. Many of these large food companies have moved their plants into the southern states where unions are a lot stronger or simply don't exist in order to get low-wage employees. Many have relied more heavily on illegal labor. I mean, we've always had a strong element of illegal labor in the produce business, but now we're seeing an uptick in the number of illegals that are being busted when they stage these raids at these big meatpacking plants. And, you know, now it turns out that that's what meat companies have to do in order to meet these cost requirements. They have to hire illegals. And it's also why we ended up in China buying our wheat, gluten, and soy protein. We're now looking for the lowest cost ingredient and going to the low bidder, essentially, and that turned out to be China. And the problem there was that China is not really set up to provide a safe volume of food.
Does China have any incentive to change their production practices?
They do, absolutely. Like any other company that, you know, gets caught up in a food safety problem, it's not good advertising to kill your customers. So China has every incentive. I mean, China's wanting to position itself as a big, high-value exporting country, and they want to position them, and certainly they'd like to be known as a safe supplier. So they are trying to revamp and come up with new regulations, but China is in a real bind because they're sort of where the United States was a century ago when Sinclair wrote his muckraking book, The Jungle, looking at the meatpacking industry. You know, China has a rapidly industrializing food system. It's expanding rapidly, adding new capacity, and its regulatory system, the government agencies that are responsible for that, ensuring safety, can't keep up. They're way behind. And I've seen estimates where China needs to spend $100 billion minimum just to bring its food system up to sort of minimum Western standards, safety standards. And so whenever you consider the low price of Chinese food, Chinese imported food, you have to understand that low price reflects the fact that Chinese have not spent that $100 billion.
My guest is Paul Roberts. He's written a book called The End of Food, published by Houghton Mifflin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It seems to me that we are hearing two very different solutions to the current problem from different quarters. Some people are saying that the answer is to produce genetically modified foods to help increase yields, and others are talking about slow food, sustainable, organic, local, et cetera. And that has been gaining a certain amount of traction in recent years, but it sure doesn't produce cheap food.
Right. And I think these really are illustrative of the, I guess, the bind, the sort of the philosophical bind we find ourselves in. You know, there's growing awareness that the system that we have doesn't work. It is suffering a number of problems, a number of technical problems, but also a number of sort of, deeper systemic problems. The basis, the ideas, the concepts on which it was based need to be rethought. So we get that. What we're challenged with now is figuring out which way to go, which way do we jump. Do we sort of move back toward a smaller scale, more locally based, more organic, that is less chemically dependent industry? Or do we move ahead to a more sophisticated version of what we have today? In other words, figuring out what's wrong by improving it with better technology, better chemicals. And that's sort of the GM model. And these are two really divergent visions. And in my view, they're both deeply flawed because they both sort of insist on looking at just a small part of the problem. And, you know, GM has all kinds of problems. I mean, there are concerns about safety and environmental impact, but for me, the real problem with GM is that the companies making GM seeds and GM products don't really care. They're not really that interested in the markets that most need the help. I mean, they want to come up with better soybeans and corn to sell to American and South American farmers because that's where the profits are. They are less concerned with coming up with GM varieties of, you know, regional crops that would actually be useful to a farmer in Kenya because there's no money there. And so that, to me, finding the ways to encourage the industry to actually design new crops for people that need them That's the challenge there. And then from the organic standpoint and local production, sort of this the other end of the spectrum, these are all really important developments, and we can learn a lot from them, and they will play a part in the next food economy, but they won't be the solution in of themselves. Organic, I mean, if you want to grow organically, you need to come up with a lot of organic fertilizers. And, you know, we right now we use manure or we use cover crops. We rotate and use crops like legumes that restore fertilizers naturally. But the problem is if you rotate and use a cover crop to restore your fertilizer, you're taking your land out of production. You're not producing corn or wheat during that one rotation, so you're reducing your output. Local production, I mean, it's wonderful. It sort of reconnects consumers to producers. The food is often fresher and better quality, but it's very hard to produce enough of it on the farms that are near to the cities. I mean, the United States, we've evolved to such a degree that there's not a lot of farmland right around cities anymore. And what farmland is available is it's so expensive that farmers have to grow these very high-value sort of niche products like free-range turkeys for Thanksgiving that, you know, are healthy and taste good, but they cost, you know, $150, and that's just not a solution to the problem. So we're going to have to sort of find ways to hybridize these solutions, that is, compromise, and that's going to be tough politically because there's a lot of purism in food politics today.
Well, did the recently passed farm bill address any of these issues?
Not really. I mean, it did in the sense that it did add some money for research into alternative agriculture, which has been sadly lacking. And you know, we need to come up with ways to farm that don't require as much fertilizer, as much oil, or as much water, because all of these things are going to be in much shorter supply going forward. But unfortunately, it also didn't take away any of the subsidies for crops that really don't need, you know, federal tax help. In fact, they added subsidies to crops that had up until now somehow managed to survive without federal subsidies. So we really went backwards. And the you know, compounding the tragedy there is that farm bills are they're in place for 5 years. So we're stuck with this one for 5 years. On the positive side, there is, you know, even if Congress can't get its act together, there's a lot of positive developments at the state and local level. You're starting to see agencies, school boards, state legislatures taking action that will have effects, you know, at least locally, encouraging, say, schools to use local production, local farm production where they can, or increasing the amount of local production that they use. And that creates demand, which then allows farmers, local farmers, to invest in new production, and it sort of primes the pump. It does, again, it's not the whole solution, but it does get the sort of ball rolling. I think probably more encouraging to me is the fact that, you know, consumers are paying attention now. High prices have been enough to really make people sit up and say, wow, this whole system is really not working well. I mean, everyone's been sort of aware of the food safety problems over the past years. We've been concerned about obesity. We've been concerned about, you know, contaminated imports. But now sort of the last straw, I think, was these food prices, and people are saying, what can I do as a consumer to sort of take back some power over the food I eat? Because I think a lot of people are realizing, wow, you know, I don't have anything to do with what I'm eating. I simply go and buy it. I don't know what many of these ingredients are. I don't know where they came from. I don't know about the quality of them. I'm simply taking the word of whichever processor made them. And I think people are now beginning to question that. And when they're finding themselves going, wow, I don't cook anymore. I certainly don't grow my own food. What can I do?
Well, I sure hope that the title is not true, the title of your book, The End of Food. I'd still like to have food even, and I hope that somewhere down the line we even resolve these problems. My great thanks to Paul Roberts, whose book, The End of Food, is published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.